Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Poddleters. I hope you're well. In this week's episode, I have a very special guest. It is my big sister, Dr. Emily Forbat. So we discuss the three things she wishes she was taught in school, and they range from sun damage to avoiding fuckboys. I love speaking to my sister. It's very chatty, and we do talk over a little bit because I guess just the familiarity of family. But I really hope you love the conversation. I've been wanting to talk to her for ages, and I really enjoyed it, and I think it's a lovely listen. She does have an Instagram if you want to follow her. It's Dr. Emily Forbat, but she hasn't been posting on it as much at the minute, and you'll hear about that in the episode. But yes, I hope you enjoy. And as always, please do rate, review, and subscribe. Bye. Hello, and welcome to Adulting. Today I'm joined by Dr. Emily Forbat.
Hello.
So, for people who don't know who you are, do you want to give us an introduction?
So, I am Anoni's big sister, and I'm a doctor.
What kind of doctor?
I'm a dermatologist, so a dermatologist in training, which means that I'm a trainee, and they train me up to be a consultant. So, I'm almost there. I'm an ST5, and basically, I became a doctor, I think, 7 or 8 years ago now, and then I've been working my way up ever since.
And you just did your final exam and smashed it?
No, well, just last exam ever.
Okay, so as you know, this season I'm asking everyone what three things they wish that they were taught in school.
Yeah.
And very topical to what you've just said, your number one thing was you wish you'd been taught how dangerous the sun really is.
I know, I really wish that. When we were young, do you not remember we used to always go to Spain every year? And genuinely, Noni and I, so our big sister gets really nice and tan, so olive skin, and we are as white as white.
You're whiter than me.
Well, anyway, we would spend 12 hours a day, honestly, I would lay there and just burn myself to a crisp.
Well, I wasn't as bad because Tiffany and you used to get up really early and go. You get up at 6 a.m, literally. And then I would always sleep in because I was younger. And then you would miss lunch because you'd be like, so I've got another 20 minutes on my back. And you would rotate like rotisserie chickens.
I can't believe I did that now. But I wish somebody had just said to me now, like when I was 18 or even, you know, younger, we were like 14, what are you doing? It's so dangerous. But we didn't really understand back then, I don't think. Well, we did, but we didn't.
But I think even now, like loads of my friends or people get sunbeds because you just kind of think it can't be that bad.
I think it's a huge cultural thing, isn't it? Because as much as someone will say to you, oh, you know, don't sunbathe, you might get skin cancer one day, you think, oh, well, it's never going to happen to me, or it will happen when I'm 60, so I won't care. But, you know, you've got a lot of living to do, even at the age of 60. You don't really want to be having things cut out or, you know, a lot of skin cancers can kill you.
So do you want to talk about why you got into dermatology? Was it down to learning this about the skin?
No, so I had a bit of a funny... I never wanted to be a dermatologist. All throughout my training, I wanted to be a surgeon. And all of my jobs leading up to where I am now were very much acute jobs. So I used to do a lot of A&E, I did anaesthetics and IT, and I absolutely loved it. And I always thought I was going to be an obstetrician. And then you kind of do your first 2 years of being a doctor, and everyone basically has a year out because you think, I do not have a clue what I want to do, and you have to kind of subspecialise at that point. And in that year out, I thought, I didn't really know, it was either between plastic surgery and dermatology. And dermatology is quite nice because it's so broad. So you're a doctor, a physician first and foremostly. So you're a diagnostician. So you're kind of doing detective work. You know, everything presents on the skin. So, you know, there's thousands and thousands of diagnoses that you need to know about. So you're never bored, really. But at the same time, you get to do a lot of surgery, which is quite unusual. You have that in obstetrics as well. But most specialties, you're either a surgeon or a doctor.
When you say year out, though, it wasn't a year out. You mean you took a year out?
I took a year out of training, but I was still working. But a lot of people kind of have a breather and think, right, what do I really want to do?
So I didn't know this as well until you went into dermatology, because I think loads of people think it's literally just looking at moles and
cosmetic stuff, but actually no. It's eye blank for me. It's super interesting.
There's no, if you're an NHS dermatologist, you don't know anything about cosmetics, really. I mean, it's a very small part of your curriculum. Being a dermatologist in the NHS means that you do a lot of skin cancer clinics. That's the most important thing. Skin cancer is on the rise and there's a huge amount of it, especially as people are living longer. So that is a big part of it. And you do have your bread and butter things like eczema and psoriasis and acne. But a lot of it as a trainee is on-call dermatology. So, you know, people in hospital come in with blistering skin conditions or skin conditions which may signify something going on internally. So it's a lot more than that. So people just often think, oh, sometimes people don't even realise that you're a doctor and you have to explain. Actually, I don't because ask me to diagnose them.
Your skin is the biggest organ in the body, isn't
yeah,
it?
Right. It is.
And you were saying, like, even with COVID, loads of stuff.
Yeah, lots of COVID. We've seen a lot of COVID. So that's interesting. I mean, obviously, it's so new that everyone's learning about it. But, you know, people who get COVID, we're learning, have lots of different skin rashes, one of them being COVID toes. I think Dad had COVID toes.
COVID toes? We as call in them literally on your toes?
We call them COVID toes.
Are you sure
toes,
he's not just got gross feet?
No. That too. But you get blue toes.
Really? Mm.
It looks like you've got chilblains, but it's... It's not real chilblains. It's to do with COVID and it can be a presenting feature.
So going back to the skin cancer sunbathing section
yeah.
of the
oh,
podcast,
yeah. Sorry.
I think, that's really good to go off topic. But I think that I'm really worried now because our mum when we were growing up used to sunbathe all the time, didn't she? Because she grew up in the era of not knowing.
I remember when I used to get spots, she'd be like, let's just get a sunbed.
Yeah, I was never
what
allowed.
What was she thinking?
Because I used to sit with you. Do you remember? You'd go after school and you'd both get 10 minutes and I'd be so jealous because I wasn't 18.
And that was the worst thing because I used to tan my face so much, I think, because I suffered with acne. And that's another thing.
It's like, an old school idea, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think even mum didn't realise that it was a medical problem. So I was never taken to a GP and I just suffered and suffered and suffered with it. And I think people are more aware now about it. Maybe we're talking, 20 years ago. Well, not quite. I'm not that old, actually. 15 years ago. My face tanned so well because I've just battered
trained
it with
it.
The sun, which is horrific. Because you forget that not only does it cause sun damage in terms of wrinkling and skin cancer, most importantly, I mean, what's the point in having a beautiful tan if in 10 years' time you're going to have a massive scar on your face? Because, by the time you cut a skin cancer out, you have to take a healthy margin of tissue and, it can be quite deforming the scars that are left. But not only that, it makes your skin saggy.
But not only that,
you lose elasticity, and that is such a... You wouldn't notice it now. Wait, by the time you're my age, you'll go, oh, you should have listened to me.
But doesn't it make your scars worse in the sun? Like, don't scars get worse in the sun rather than better? Because I thought that was an old school idea where they thought that if you blast your skin, like the acne...
No, I think the sun does help certain skin diseases. So
like psoriasis.
Often people with psoriasis will go and have UV light treatment and other inflammatory disorders. It does help, but that's a controlled sunbed. So, they're measuring your skin type, working out how much you can tolerate. And even then, if you have over a certain amount, you might need to have a yearly skin check to assess for skin cancer. So there is a time and a place where you need to have UV light therapy and the benefit can outweigh the risk. But if you're going to a sunbed, down the street, that is, first of all, UVA rays, which are very dangerous and doesn't have UVB rays. And they're not controlled. So you have absolutely no way of knowing the amount that you're getting. So it's going to do nothing for you.
Because what I didn't realise, we've always loved to tan, because our mum's always loved to tan. Also, like you said, it's quite like a British thing, because it's such like a cold climate, so you don't get a tan.
Pale.
But you were saying any form of tan is sun damage,
well,
skin
essentially,
damage.
You have melanocytes in your skin, and depending on your skin type, you might be more prone to becoming more tan. So if you are olive skin...
And you just pick up the sun.
And you pick up the sun, you're less likely to get sun damage than someone like me, for example, who's very fair... I've probably got the fairest skin type you have. So it's your body's defence against the sun. You're effectively creating little umbrellas, if you imagine, in your skin to stop the sun, the damaging rays coming through and prevent the cells getting so damaged that they become a skin cancer. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that's a really good example.
So I think the thing is, people think, oh, well, it's just a healthy glow. And there really isn't any real, I don't believe in a healthy glow. If you've got a tan... then there's sun damage there, ultimately.
I've got Factor 50 on now and it's the middle of December because you make me wear it all the time.
and also putting enough on. I mean, that's the other thing. So if you were to really cover your body from head to toe in the sunscreen, say theoretically you were going out into the sun, then you should use like 36 tablespoons.
Hello, sorry, this is a quick fact check. Emily said 36 tablespoons, but she actually meant 36 grams, which equates to 6 teaspoons. So I just wanted to add that in there so that we didn't get that wrong. We were just excitedly talking. So there you go. Go back to listening and enjoy.
I mean, as if.
Like a whole bottle.
People just, yeah. So we know that we don't use it correctly. So people go for, oh, I think I only need, you know, a lower factor. But you're better off, because we know people don't apply it correctly, using a higher factor. Mm. And not only just a high factor, it needs to have a broad spectrum UVA rating as well. Because people forget, you know, if you're, oh, I don't go outside. It's like, well, how did you get here then? So if you're going in a car, you will get UVA rays coming through a car window. So you need to have sun cream which has got UVA protection. I mean, lots of people don't realize that. You know, like, have you seen that picture of the lorry driver?
Yeah, where half
one
their face
side
is...
of the face is so wrinkly.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I wish somebody had said to me, I mean, it's my favorite thing in the world, if you get a young girl coming into clinic, say they're kind of 15, and then they have a skin check, and it's just like the perfect opportunity to hopefully prevent them. Like, oh, if only someone told me that then. Most importantly, to prevent them from having skin cancer, but also from an anti-aging perspective.
Because it's true, we spend so much money on creams and people end up getting Botox and stuff, and like, you don't actually need to pay for that if you just wear
sun lotion. The best cream you can invest in is doesn't matter which sunscreen you use, but a sunscreen that you're happy to use every day. Put it on your face, your ears, your neck, the backs of your hands. And if you know, if you're a man, I mean, my fiance goes mad. He's always out and about because of his job, and he's got no hair, so I'm just make him, you know,
slather
it on.
My favourite one is the SkinCeuticals one that I wear as a moisturiser, but it's quite expensive.
Yeah.
That was very informative. Thank you. I'm sure people will have questions afterwards. Okay, so the second thing that you said that you've been wished that you were taught in school, you have to explain what you mean to me. You said how to really live life and not waste it. It's a good one, but I want to know what you mean by that.
So what do I mean by that? I wish I'd prepped for this. So what I mean is when you go to school, everyone says, oh, what are you going to do? You know, what do you want to be? And all this kind of stuff. No one actually talks to you about why you're doing it. So what, you know, I think I've spent a lot of time doing this. Like, I've just got to get this exam done. I've just got to get this piece of coursework done, get through this block of on calls, and then I can enjoy life X, Y, Z. And then before you know it, I'm 31. I'm thinking, bloody hell, like, all that time ago, I'm so old. And so what I mean is that living your life is just in that moment, not like wishing for tomorrow, is in that exact moment, whatever you're doing, even if it's the most mundane thing, you know, in your life, that you're enjoying it. Because, I mean, before I did dermatology, not so much now, we don't really get this, but when I was a junior doctor, I don't know why, I think I've had, well, all doctors have a fair share of kind of sad stories, and we often don't, we talk about the funny ones, we don't talk about the sad ones because it's too difficult. But I do just remember, of those sad stories, people who are dying, and you talk to them just before they're dying, they always try and give you, it's funny, like, well, obviously some of them are too sick to do it, but it's normally like in the weeks leading up to or whatever, and they just always say, you know, your life is just so short. And I know it's such a, everyone says it, but they always think, no, who cares? Not, and no one's going to go, oh, yeah, they were an amazing dermatologist, an absolute arsehole. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You'd rather be known for who you are and like actually living your life. You know, it could be so quick. One minute you're, you know, fine, and then you're in a massive car crash, and then that's it. So what's the point in waiting?
Yeah.
I haven't explained it very well.
No, you have. I love it. You always tell me those stories about how you'll be with like a really little old woman, and she'll be like, don't have any regrets. Just do whatever you want to do. Like, you'll never regret the things you did. You'll only ever regret all the things that you didn't do.
And also wasting, I mean, I'm the worst for it because I say this, but I think it's because I find it hard to live by it. So if something quite drastic happens, or really, you know, signifying at work, and then I'll think, God, I really do need to just enjoy life and live it. But then you forget, and then life just carries on and it goes as normal. But before you know it, you are 60. And...
But that's the thing. I think it's such a privilege. I think in my work, I'm given so much more room to like really find the joy because I get so much freedom. Whereas I think with your job, you literally don't stop. I mean, you've had to stop now because Emily's having to take time for work because you've got long COVID. We can talk about that later. But I think you're so back to back and so busy that like lots of people, it's such a privilege to actually be able to stop and be like, oh my God, take it all in. But I think once you start realizing that you can do that, then it helps. Like, Joe, your fiance, is really good at being like that. Do you think that's what made you a bit more like that as well?
Well, no, he is generally a very positive person. And, yeah, he does live in the moment, but he can because he's, well...
Yeah.
It's difficult, isn't it? I don't know. There's been certain things that happen that make you really think, ooh. I always remember when I worked in intensive care. This is going back a few years ago. And actually, it was the old SARS, the SARS one. And there was a patient who was he was a billionaire. But he had I think I can say this because I'm not kind of
giving
anything away, but it's just an example of things where you think, gosh, this is what is really important. And he was a billionaire and he had a pre-existing lung condition and he got really unwell. So he was absolutely, obviously, desperate. If you've got all that money, you just want to buy your health, right? So, you know, there was this big thing about how they were like, well, we'll put him on a private jet and he'll come over and he could go on this special treatment and would he be able to go on the lung transplant list and all this stuff. And what was really sad about it is he had every single kind of means to have that in terms of like wealth. So he could have bought the whole hospital probably. But if you have to be a certain level of healthy for being fit enough to have a lung transplant, for example, I can't remember the exact thing of what it was. And there's nothing they could do because he would not survive that. So it's like he was trying to buy his life.
So he believed that he you think money can buy you everything.
Yeah,
that can't.
I think what I'm trying to say, your health, you realise when it comes down to it, the most wealthy people are those who are healthy. Until you kind of are unwell, you don't really realise how lucky you are to be able to just walk down the street and not be in pain or, you know, not have a chronic illness. I can't even imagine what it's like for these people who just suffer and they keep going.
Mm. That is really interesting to look at like that. And I think that it's funny because I've done a podcast before about success where I was talking to Louise Trelan, and we were saying how everyone always puts everything down to money. Yeah. But realistically, like if you've got you could be the richest person in the world, but if you've got an unhappy relationship and you don't have people that are around you that are going to look after you, like what's the point?
Exactly.
There's literally no point in
it. Hopefully one day we have children and I was at really good, I'm sure lots of people have seen this, but at school, I would much rather a teacher say, I don't know what the name would be.
Oh, what, to the child?
Yeah, to the child. I don't know, just like role play.
She doesn't want to say the name in case someone knows it.
Oh, yeah, no, everyone steals my baby names. It's really annoying. I'm also not pregnant, just putting it out there. but I'd much rather they say, oh, little so-and-so, she's struggling a bit with maths, but she is just the loveliest little girl or something like that. She's a really kind person. Like, that's so much more important than being like, oh, well, she's got an A star in maths, but she's an absolute... I can't swear on here, can I?
You can swear. Okay. But no, I agree. But also, I think that's our generation because I feel like our parents are brought up, which is so important because that generation wanted you to be able to work hard and achieve and do really well. But I think it's a privilege to be able to be like, look, I just want them to be happy.
No, that is a privilege, me saying that stuff. I know what you mean. Like, obviously, you have to work hard as well.
As long as they work, that's the thing. I think if you teach someone to work hard,
to try,
then that's what's important.
Yeah.
Whereas I thought I had to get, I mean, you literally do get A stars in everything you do to this day. She gets 99%. Emily, when you did your GCSEs, was like, I can't look. It's too stressful. When we were on holiday in Spain, I looked and it was literally 11 A stars. And then the next year, she'd be like, I failed everything. And then it was A levels and they didn't do A stars back then, but it was all A's. And then recently she was like, oh my God, I've definitely failed this
exam.
But
I do believe that I failed.
And then she sends it over and it's 96%, 99%, 98%. And this has been going on for 10 years.
No, but I think for that, it's because when you're a doctor, the sad thing is you have to do, I mean, I've been doing exams for 13 years and you have to pay for them all yourself, which is so sad.
So you don't want it.
If I fail it, it's going to cost me a small fortune.
Yeah, that is wild.
Yeah.
What other good stories do you have from, because you mentioned earlier that you were going to do obs because you did your BSc in obs and gynae, didn't you?
Not my BSc. So I did a job. You do your normal degree, your medical degree.
What was your BSc?
You are right. My BSc, it was in maternal and fetal health. And I loved labour and delivery. I found it so fascinating. Now I've gone the other way and absolutely terrified from the things I've seen. And I remember seeing this title and being like, this is what I'm going to do it in. And it was evacuatory problems in women postpartum who've had third and fourth degree tears. So I was thinking in my head, well, evacuatory, that means the baby's not coming up. That's really fascinating. But actually it was all to do with these poor women who'd have, third and fourth degree tears, tears all the way through to your
perineum.
And then they couldn't go to do a poo and all that kind of problem. And so then I spent all this time like, oh, it was just very, what it was very interesting. As in, you know, they would have connections between their vagina and the anus. So then like they might poo out of their vagina. And so, oh, it's really, this is rare. This is like, I can't remember what the percentage incidence is. It's low. It's like 1% or something, but it is quite scarring when you're doing that for a while. But yeah, I loved it. I found it really interesting.
Because when I read This Is Going to Hell by Adam Kay, you were like, thank God you read it. Now you know what my life is like. Because you were like, it's so realistic.
It's such a good representation. Because I think people have this idea that if you're a doctor, then everyone's like really nice to you at work and all the doctors here. And it's just hilarious because everyone's just like, treats you like shit half the time. And you're just, I don't know.
Because you'd always tell me, you're like, something happens. Like if a patient dies, you'll like get in a cupboard and cry. And then you have to pretend that like nothing's happened.
Yeah, well, I think there's not time, which is the really sad thing.
I think people think doctors don't get upset, though. I think they think, like, oh, you've trained yourself.
Some are very good at it. I'm the worst. I can't. I remember when I worked in Canterbury, and I was only very junior, but there was there wasn't much senior support there. So when you work in, like, a DGH, so district general, as opposed to, like, a big teaching hospital, often you carry a lot more responsibility as a junior than as a kind of more senior doctor. And I remember it was horrific. This family, like, rushed in thinking that the family member was still alive and we'd been doing like CPR. They'd been in arrest for ages and they weren't going to make it. And they'd just been told, oh, they're in recess. And you just assume, don't you, that they're, oh, how are they? Are they fine? I remember they came and they had all this expectation and they were young that this family member were fine. I remember that awful moment of having to tell somebody that, you know, not only they're not fine, they've not made it. But then you, which is horrific. And obviously, for them, more so, that's why you get upset. But then you've got the rest of your shift to do, so you might, you'll say it. I mean, I am the worst. I find it really hard to distance myself.
So I would be so bad.
No, I also get like tears in my eyes as well. So it looks like I'm crying even when I'm not crying, which is sad.
I do that as well when I'm talking about something that I find funny or interesting. I start crying.
Yeah.
So
you do have a little cry and then you just carry on. But some people are amazing. They don't. I'm really good at compartmentalizing. So something really awful will happen and then I will literally kind of put it to one side and carry on, and then I will deal with it at a later point.
Yeah, I can't do that. I just wear my emotions on my sleeve.
Yeah, you do that,
right at the surface, ready to come up, especially if I'm drunk.
Yeah, you do.
What was I gonna say? But it's interesting because like the hours that you work, so for instance, when I was younger, not that Dad was a glamorous doctor, but Dad is a doctor. I used to think, like, being a doctor was such a glamour. It was like, everyone was like, you could be a doctor or a lawyer. It was, like, one of the top jobs.
It's, like, the worst thing ever. Do not let your child be a doctor.
I would never let
my child be a doctor.
Would you not?
No. I say that. So I've gone too far. I'm in too deep now. I just can't. I'm, like, I'm almost there. I might as well finish it. But
There's times when you wanted to quit.
There's so many more amazing things you can do. I think the way the NHS is at the moment, you do just get work to the bone. I mean, I'm lucky in what the career I've chosen has got a lot better work-life balance than others. But, you know, if you work in Australia or America, I think you get treated a lot better.
But that's more because the NHS is underfunded rather than because the NHS isn't good. Because when Mum was a nurse, it was like she loved it. Like the stories of her in the hospitals are amazing. Sounds like...
Yeah, it's a different thing back then, I think. I mean, the NHS is incredible. Like, you cannot really fault it. Like, if a family member is truly sick, you know, if they've had a massive car accident or need cancer treatment, I don't think there's really any other health service in the world that is comparable in terms of when you really, really need it. I think people get frustrated with it when they need it for things that aren't
urgent.
Yeah, they are urgent because it affects their quality of life hugely. But it, you know, because it's trying to concentrate so much on those life-saving treatments or things that are, you know, the core of medicine, I think those things have to kind of fall by the wayside because, I mean, it's amazing to think that you can walk into an A&E and just get treated without having to pay.
It's ridiculous to think about.
People have no idea, you know, what things cost.
What would you wish that people would know? Because, like, I remember just being so shocked at the sheer amount of hours you would do. Like, you would, I remember the saddest thing was once Emily had a weekend off for the first time in like months and months and months, and you finished like a 48-hour shift because you've been made to work overtime, and then you were meant to go on this weekend. You were meant to get on a flight somewhere and you were so tired that she just slept. She just passed out for like 12 hours and we were all ringing her and we were like, oh my God, she's died. And her phone had just fallen down the side and she was so tired. She
missed the flight.
Because you just, because sometimes you'd be working and think you were going to come off and then there wouldn't be another doctor and they'd be like, sorry, you're going to have to stay. And obviously you stay.
Yeah, well, that doesn't happen. I don't think they really let you do that so much now. So it is better now. I think patients just don't realise. So obviously, for example, for what I do now, mainly I'm either doing a surgical list or a clinic. And so it is annoying for patients. You'll always get, you get the most amazing little old grannies who I just want to take home with me. And they will sit there for like 5 hours and not complain. I just love them so much. And then you get these young, you know, and quite entitled people who often have nothing wrong with them and they're the ones that complain. So, you know, it is annoying. You turn up, you get told your appointment's at 10 a.m. and then you get seen an hour and a half late. But what they don't see is that as a doctor, you will get in an hour earlier. You won't even have time to probably go to the loo and you just work with work because it's just so understaffed and you'll be seeing these patients and then you will go straight from a morning clinic into an afternoon clinic. You won't have time to go have lunch, really. Or if you have lunch, you eat it over 5 minutes. And you're also, whilst doing a clinic, will be on call. So, you know, I'll have to see patients during a clinic and then normally you're holding a bleep. So if there is an emergency, you have to kind of somehow figure out, you know, you have to prioritise and work out, you know, the really bad ones you see straight away, for example, or when you're going to see them. So I think patients just see that they're waiting. And you can understand it's really annoying. Mm. They're like, I've been waiting here for an hour and a half. But I don't think they quite see the pressures that you're under because you're making, you know, in a day, I make hundreds and hundreds of decisions. And luckily, because I'm still a trainee, it's so nice that I'm constantly asking the consultant because that's your one time to learn. So I always ask questions because you'll always learn some sort of nugget of information, even if you think you know the answer. They've been experienced, been doing it for years and years and years. But it's a lot of pressure. Like if you make a wrong decision and you send someone home who's got a melanoma, you've made that mistake.
It's also, I think that's definitely true that we don't see the pressures and that's really, because even I've been there before, like if I'm waiting to go and get a pill or something, if I'm like at a sexual health clinic and you're like, oh my God, I've been there for like hours.
But actually, you forget. So when they get in, you've got like, you know, you'll have like a 100-year-old walk in and then you've got to check the skin all over. It takes like half an hour for them to take the clothes off. And then they need to have a break and then you're like, okay, you can't like rush them. It's just the saddest thing in the world. And then so you've got to examine them. And then if they've got something there that looks worrying, then you'll need to take a photograph, you have to get consent for the photograph, then you'll have to book them for surgery. You have to take a thorough history, obviously, to make sure and work out. Because often, you know, people say, oh, can you just quickly look at this? It's not anything quick about it. Like, I need to know what you do for a living. I need to know all your social history, your past medical history, your medication, your allergies. Do you have a pacemaker? There's a whole load of things you've got to ask. And yes, it is focused and you get quicker as you're more experienced. But there's a lot going on. And then you might need to put them a scan. You might need to put them blood tests. You might need to organise some type of biopsy there. And then there's often like a million things going on behind that door. And then they've got to get dressed again. That takes another hour. And you're like,
hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Do you think that people having access to Google has made your job easier or harder? Like, do you think that some people are able to look at stuff on Google and go, oh, it's fine? Or do you think they do what I do, which is think I'm dying every 5 minutes? I suppose they've always had it since you've been a doctor.
I think I haven't noticed it as much because we've grown up with it. So you're used to patients being more empowered and having more knowledge. So
is it not annoying when they come in there and they're like, because this is what I would do? And be like, so I've definitely got this.
No, I don't find it annoying because I understand the anxiety there.
Yeah.
So, but it's trying, often people do have like a fixed belief and they're like, no, it's definitely this. And you're like trying to explain to them why. But that's not often the case. Often actually, it's actually not as big a cohort as you would think. Most people still do come in and I think you're very anxious when you go to the doctor because that's like a mass. I forget that I'm seeing one of, you know, so many patients in a day, and this they'll be probably thinking about for 2 weeks. I got skin cancer? So for them, it's a really big thing. And, you know, it's a lot of anxiety that comes. They don't know whether I'm going to turn around and say, you know, sometimes in a clinic, some people come in and have to say, look, we think this is a melanoma. We need to get this off now. And they might die from that. So people, you know, it's natural to kind of catastrophize and think the worst thing's going to happen.
This is why you're a doctor, because you've got so empathetic in this situation. I feel so bitchy.
I mean, no, don't get me wrong, people piss me off. But on the whole, I'm like, no, I must understand.
So when, just quickly, I want to circle back to this question ever so quickly, but going back to really living your life, are there any small things that you've implemented that make you feel like you're living your life?
So I think it's just about, I mean, I'm sure everybody does this, but this is my like thing that I do, is just trying to enjoy whatever it is that I'm doing. So even if it's the most mundane thing, like even if, you know, you're going for a walk with your friend, that might become like the most important memory because you might never see that friend again. Do you know what I mean? Like
everything circles around someone dying with you.
Yeah, but that it's true. But I think that it does for me because I've seen so much of it.
So true.
I've seen so much death, and it sounds so morbid, but you just don't know when you're going to pop your clogs.
But that's why you can never have an argument and not make up as well.
Yeah.
And you always have to say love you, even if you're in a fight, which is what we do. Yeah. Through gritted teeth.
Yeah. I think that's what I'm not very eloquent. I'm probably not the right person to
You are, you're such a good guest. I'm loving this conversation. It's really interesting.
Okay. But I don't really... it's hard to explain it. Joe would be better at explaining it. He's very good at living his best life.
I think you explain it really well. I think basically you're so right that every aspect of your life is geared towards the next goal. So when you're at school, it's like, wait, you've got to get your GCSEs, then it's your A-levels, then it's your degree. Then after your degree, you've got to get your job. And then once you get your job, and it's constant.
Yeah, and you think, oh, I've done that, like, I'll be happy and I'll be complete.
Yeah.
But actually, you realise that life isn't about completing things. You're always going to be have moments of happiness and sadness and struggles and difficulties. And so... you know, it's never going to be plain sailing. If even if you're, you know, we used to always say, oh, I always, actually, it's one of my favourite things to do. Like, if I won the lottery, I would buy this, 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 and this. And like, not for me, for everybody else. Like, I have this, you know, we always have this conversation about what
we work
buy.
Out how much money we give for mum and dad.
Yeah,
and then we get really excited.
And
we get
and, like,
so
dropping
excited.
Around the keys, like the Aston Martin, all this kind of stuff anyway. And then you're like, oh, and then life would be fine. But actually you realise that, no, nothing probably changes. It might be a bit easier in the sense that you don't have to worry about paying for certain things, but...
But Emily honestly genuinely buys a lottery ticket every week. And every week tells me that she's going to win.
I genuinely believe.
But we have dreams. I do all the time where we think about, because all we ever want to do is like make sure our mum and dad are like safe and happy. So we're like, we'll get them a house. Dad will get an Aston Martin. Mum will have a flat in London. So she can come and see us all the time.
Yeah, but I've changed it now because I would do Cheltenham. So
you can't take her away from me. She wants to be in London.
She can't bear it because now Olive and I hang out a lot more.
It's really upsetting.
Because we're closer, whereas Mum used to always come to London, but now she's...
so sad.
You've been ditched.
No, I think that's such a good explanation of it, and you're so right. It's like, I feel the same way as well, that I would always want the next thing, and because you're always comparing to people around you, there's always going to be someone better than you. So I'll look at some of my friends and I'm like, oh, I haven't done that. Whereas actually if I sit and reflect on where I am, like I'm really happy.
You need to like check yourself, don't you, and say, because I'm the worst. I get anxious about, I never used to, it's funny. I think it's an age thing, a lockdown
I've
thing.
I've got
maybe.
Really anxious as well.
So yeah, you just have to, I think if you consciously try and be happy, you are happier. I'm saying it like as if I'm not happy, I'm really happy. As in I'm very lucky.
No, you're making really... But it's really easy to fall into that trap of feeling like a negative, not even necessarily negative, but just not being present in the moment.
Yeah, exactly. That's
what it is. It's like you kind of go through the motions of the day. You get back home from work. You might be like, oh, I'm tired. And then I'm going to have dinner. And then you wake up in the morning before you know it's been like 3 weeks.
That's a whole day that's gone.
Yeah. And just nothing's happened.
Yeah.
There's another thing that I love that's like today is... the oldest you've ever been and the youngest you'll ever be. And that's true of every moment in your life.
That's a really good
saying. Such a good way of thinking about it.
There's another quote. One of the dermatologists who I absolutely love. He's so cute. I was so worried I was going to kill him off with my COVID because he came to visit me on the wards. And I was like, get away from me, because he should have retired
the
years
old
ago.
One.
Yeah.
Aww.
Literally love him. He's like the god of like dermatology where we train. Anyway, so during the pandemic, he would every morning to kind of cheer us up, we'd have this like morning huddle, apart from you're not meant to huddle because clearly COVID at times, but we would do it remotely. And at the end of it, he would always say like a proverb or a very profound, you know, saying or a poem. And he's just very old school and just so lovely. And one of them, he said, I'm saved it on my phone. It was so good. It's like, don't let tomorrow's, don't let tomorrow's troubles take away today's peace.
Oh yeah, I love
something
that.
Something like that. I can't remember how it was, but it was so good. And he'd come up things, he'd think, oh, and I would always like text and shape, like, oh, this is today's one. So when I left, I bought him a book of Proverbs and he literally loves it every day. He's like, we've got an Emily's Proverb.
That's so
But it's really nice because then it makes you actually think about things.
But that's a really good one because it reminds me of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And in that...
She's so much reading.
The guy... No, that's the... You know, the new films of the Harry Potter films.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he says something like... there's no point worrying about something that hasn't happened because then it means you suffer twice.
Yeah, which that's is so basically true. The same I do that
thing.
All day long.
Yeah, that's what we do. So Matt never does this. So I will catastrophize about something that is never going to happen and then panic all day for no reason. Was you shouldn't
it's
wait.
My favourite thing to do.
Okay, so let's move on to your last thing that you wish you were taught in school, which I think is a really important one. It's how to avoid fuckboys.
This was your idea, actually.
Well, it's we both unfortunately fallen into the trap. Boy. Not anymore.
No, we hate them now.
We've recovered.
Oh, we have, haven't we? Found our special people. I mean, how do you avoid a fuckboy?
I think basically you don't date the kind of person that you think is hot.
Anyone who uses sunbeds, out the window. If they blow dry their hair, absolute goner. I think going for men with no hair is safest.
I remember when Emily had got this new theory that you should go out with someone who's like, you don't think is that hot. And I just started going out with Matt. And I think Matt is so hot. So then I couldn't tell her because I was going to tell her that we were out for brunch.
But Matt is actually a rarity. Obviously, you can be very good looking. And Joe, oh my God, Joe, stop it. He'll be listening. Joe is beautiful, actually, his face.
It's because you guys look like twins.
No, but he has got a very beautiful face. He's got no hair. So when his friends had to shave their hair off, you realise how symmetrical the face is. It's amazing. Whereas, like, normally people's hair disguised, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm not saying that. I mean, Joe is very good looking, but he's not, like, he doesn't care about what he looks like. Yeah. Whereas Matt does care about what he looks like, but he's actually a very lovely person. Like, I don't think
care
Matt
about
is
it
a fuckboy, obviously.
Matt's obviously not a fuckboy.
No, he's lovely.
But what else? What are other basically, this is a really good point, actually. We used to, in both of our relationships separately, be made to feel constantly on edge and think it was our own fault. And that's such a red flag because Matt never makes me feel...
Yeah, I remember when I first started to... actually, our friend set us up. So Joe and I met. One of my really good friends from school was like, you have to go on a date with Joe. And I was like, oh, I'm not going on a date with one of your friends, especially not one of those kind of boys, thinking that he was like going to be another one of those, you know, fuck boys. And I remember us chatting and him being so lovely to the point where I was like, someone must have his phone. This can't be a true conversation. Like, who talks about this? And then I realised that I'd just been with the most horrific assholes all this time and thought it was normal.
That's the same thing.
I think you then just keep going with the same ones.
You do.
So I would have never, like... It's weird. I think Ed must have known that we would have got on and we are so similar. It's weird. Like, everything we think, we've got exactly the same life values and we are just best friends. But I would have never realised that unless somebody had kind of put me in that direction.
I also think you almost get, like, not addicted to, but get really used to being playing, like, cat and mouse and having to impress someone constantly.
Well, I think when you're younger, you think that's exciting, don't you?
Yeah.
You kind of feel like the, I don't know, it does seem exciting, but actually realise as you get older... It's not about that.
And also, like, someone letting you be, just be who you are and not be, like, you don't have to act up. Like, anything that I do, anything that you do, Joe and Matt thinks it's the best thing that we've ever done.
Yeah.
Even
so
if it's, like, really embarrassing. They're like, oh, my God, it was amazing when you got really drunk and cried. I loved it. It was so great for everyone. It was a really emotional experience.
Yeah. But I think it is a learning. You almost have to do it to kind of... You almost need to meet those assholes to make you realise what's important in life. But I think I wouldn't be, weirdly...
The same person.
...who I am today if I hadn't had those experiences. And I do regret them because I'm like, oh, I can't believe I wasted so much time and energy on that. And they were just dicks in general. But at the same time, I think if I hadn't been treated those ways... I mean, this is my perspective, obviously, that from their point of view, they might think differently. Then I may not be... who I am today. You know what I mean? Everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
You just wish you didn't waste so much time.
No, I agree. And also, I always think, loads of people think that everything happens for a reason thing is, like, really trite, but it actually really helps me.
I do think it's true.
I love it because then I look back and I'm like, I'm exactly where I'm supposed
time.
To be. Like, this only happened. And I can trace everything back. Like, my worst relationships, I always think, without that weird moment, I would never have then decided to go and start my Instagram or whatever.
Everything's like a butterfly effect.
Yeah.
That's what's so scary. Like, one decision, one wrong thing, you know, choose the wrong person, then...
But then it also depends on what day of the week it is, because sometimes it's quite nice to think that everything's completely random and irrelevant, so that you're just like...
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
But what else do we need to say about avoiding fuckboys? I think the main thing is if you feel suddenly like out of sorts or that you have to, because it is a really weird feeling. I remember just feeling constantly on edge, like I had to Like I was going to do the wrong thing. And it's because they're constantly gaslighting you and making you feel like you're going insane.
That's what's so interesting is I used to get called a psycho the whole time in one of my previous relationships. And I think I was a psycho. But that's because I was made to be a psycho. So whereas now, I say this to Joe and he's like, he cannot imagine it because we just don't really fight. We just, and he, but also he treats me so well that we wouldn't really, I mean, if we fight, it's probably my fault. Do you know what I mean? But it's unusual because I don't think he would be able to imagine who I was as a person back then, but you're made to be something, you know, that you're not.
Well, the same happens with Matt though. Matt and Joe are so, so similar. And like, they just will never argue over petty things. They'll never create an argument. They just don't want drama. But I've been in relationships before where I would tell Matt what my ex would do to me and how that made me react, and he was like, well, obviously you're going to react like that. They literally like goading, it's like getting an animal poking and like poking it with a stick. You should never poke the bear.
Do not poke the bear. It's a bad idea. But yeah, it's hard, isn't it? I think, well, people just have to, I mean, that's just a tongue-in-cheek thing. I think people just have to go through the experiences. And I think also there's so much pressure. Everyone's like, oh, I just have to be married and have children. And you realise actually everything's so cyclical. Mm. Like there'll be people who've been married for like 10 years that will then be divorced. And then there'll be other people at that stage who will have just had a baby. And so you realise as you get older that there isn't any time frame for anything. Nothing really matters.
Well, I think like that's what weird when you finish uni and you finish school is that at school you're all at the same level. And then suddenly when you finish uni and you go into the world, like some, I'm living with my boyfriend, but some of my friends are living in a house share that they've been in for 4 years. And so people are engaged, someone has a baby.
Yeah.
So everyone's at completely different points in their lives. And I think it's the first time in your life when you're like, oh my God, we're not on the level playing field. And it can make you feel quite insecure if you think, oh my God, I haven't met the person I'm meant to
be with. That's society for you, because everyone says to you, oh, so what do you do?
Yeah.
And do you have a boyfriend? Do you have children? It's like, why are you asking me this?
Yeah, exactly. You should ask me that. Are you happy?
Today? Yeah. But no one asks that because it's so ingrained, isn't it?
Well, then maybe we should make sure that we ask people that. I always ask people what they do, and you really shouldn't actually do that. It's so bad.
Because they might not want to talk about it, or they might be embarrassed by the job, or...
Yeah,
or... You know, it's such a fine line, because we've always been taught... Well, I feel like we've been taught you shouldn't ask too many questions.
Well, I do now. It's my job.
Well, yeah, I know. But like, it can be, I sometimes think it can be rude if you ask too many questions. Because you don't know what people's background is, or what they don't want to say, or how it's going to make them feel. So I always worry that I come across rude because I don't ask questions. Because I'm worried about offending people. I do at work.
You do ask questions, but you ask really nice, you're not very probing because you don't want to make people feel uncomfortable, insecure, or like, you know, you're asking. But that's just part of who you are, because everything you do is really thoughtful about to a fault. You think about the other person. Do you know what I mean? But sometimes I'm like a bit of a bulldog and I try and shop and I just want to know.
Yeah, you just love to know the goss.
Love.
But it is good that I suppose it's your job, isn't it, really?
Yeah. I don't mean like I didn't probe you too much.
No, I wouldn't answer. I hate talking. I've just realised there might all be these people listening to us.
Yeah, there will be people listening.
We were having a chat.
I think this is such a good episode.
Oh, God.
Is there anything else that you wanted to add? We haven't actually been talking. It's only been 40 minutes.
Oh, really? God, you said that the conversation would just peter out, and it has. What else should we talk about?
Are there any other things you wish you'd been taught in school?
I wish you'd got me to prep this, because
I did ask you a few days ago.
Things in school. Finances, that's a big one. Absolutely no idea about anything to do with finances, but everyone says that. Can't think. No.
Okay, well, we don't have to do any more. That's good. I think it's a really good episode.
Is it done?
No.
Oh, okay.
Well, we can be done. I can edit that.
Okay,
you can quite edit funny.
That. Shut up. No, please do. So, yeah. So what did you wish that you'd been taught in school?
What?
Let's turn this around.
Okay, well, I'll be the interviewer. I hadn't thought about that. I wish I'd been taught that there were more jobs. Like, I wish I knew that I could have done this.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
But you couldn't really back then. It's like quite a new thing.
No, but I could have, like, what I wish is that all of my reports would be like, she's really clever, but she doesn't stop talking. And no one was like, maybe she would like to go into presenting. Why don't we try and put on, like, some kind of course or something? So I spent ages from I thought I wanted to do medicine, so I did 4 A-levels, because I was, like, determined that I had to do medicine as well.
I think the whole curriculum needs to be looked at.
Yeah.
Really. Everything's so old-fashioned. Like, why do we even learn about algebra? Like, when in your life are you ever going to, like, get a calculator out?
Or this geography.
Yeah.
Just pointless.
I mean, that could be kind of handy. I mean, I never did geography. It's beyond me, but... Yeah, I think things need to be changed. Like, things need to be more vocational. Like, would you like to be a, I don't know, a journalist? Let's I don't know.
And like, our school's really good for that. If you're into sport, they would really push you. But I just wish that I constantly felt like I wasn't doing the right thing, and I couldn't ever, I was like a round peg in a square hole because I didn't know what I was meant to be doing. So I think that would be number one. My second thing, I wish I'd learned that you can exercise for fun. I just always thought about weight loss, and then I never enjoyed it. And now I love exercising.
Yeah, that's interesting. See, I love exercising, but obviously I can't at the moment because I've not been well. But yeah, I've never done it for, I think because I was always sporty, wasn't I, at school? Yeah. So I did it because of sport. But now if I'm going to exercise, I do it because it makes you feel better rather than...
It does. That's the thing that I've learned that I never used to realise, is that exercising for me...
It's endorphins.
It's how you feel afterwards. It just makes your day. Like, it's not really about anything else. What other thing would I wish I was learned in school? I'm trying to think what we weren't taught. Probably about money and finances. I've learned so much about finances through doing this podcast. And now, and Matt, and now I love, like, being really good at saving.
Yeah, I wish someone had said to me, taught me about compound interest, because then if I knew about that back then, I'd be so rich.
Oh, we would have been so buzzing. You could have saved all the 20p's you stole from me.
God, don't. I just spend all my money on presents.
Yeah,
you do. I would be so rich if I didn't buy birthday presents.
You'd be so rich if you didn't try and buy wine for everyone every time you go out, and then be like, oh my God, it's fine. And then the next day, be like, I just spent £500.
No, I don't do that. I don't even have £500 in my
account. No, I know. It's spent like £50.
Also, you can't go out anymore.
No, I know. But if you could.
Yeah. Gosh, those would be the days. But yeah, exercise is an interesting one.
Yeah, it's good. Do you want to talk about your long COVID?
Oh, yeah, we could talk about the long COVID.
So, because people don't know, of people don't know this is a thing.
So, how did it start? So, I was unwell. No, I didn't think I was unwell. In April, early April, I had really bad abdominal pain, and I hate going to hospital because it's horrible being the other way around. So, I was trying not to go in, but I knew that I probably had appendicitis, but I was just holding it off. Eventually went in, and it was during the peak of the pandemic. So Joe was like coming with, he does get really worried. And then they wouldn't let me have anyone come in with me. So they kind of rushed me in and then just take you straight to like the surgical wards. And so anyway, I had appendicitis. They'd confirmed it, but then they wanted to just scan on a CT scan before taking me to theatre. But because it was the peak, they're like, oh, just, they didn't even tell me actually, they scanned my chest at the same time. So I remember like going down in the wheelchair and being, thinking everything was fine. I was just going to have a quick operation coming in and out. And then got out the scan and they were like, do you work here? And I was like, yeah. And they all looked really worried and in full PPE. And I was like, oh my God, something's happened. And I think they were just trying to be nice because they were worried about me, like make small talk. And they took me back to the wards and they'd had to like close the whole of the ward off that I was in because obviously I basically, my CT scan had shown I had pneumonia on my CT. And then they were like, shit, she's got COVID. So then they put me into the side room. And I had absolutely no chest symptoms at that point, just appendicitis symptoms. But I was absolutely, I was in there for like a week and I should have realised, but I was so out of it. I just was... didn't wake. I was asleep the whole time, essentially, which you wouldn't have with a normal appendicitis. No. And they couldn't operate because my chest, they were like, too dangerous with your pneumonia. So I was really unwell.
But you did have a bad chest. You just hadn't realised you've been well. Like, you just hadn't
I think at that point I didn't have any chest. I'm just fatigued, which can be a sign of pneumonia. And the whole thing, it transpired, the appendicitis and the pneumonia were all interlinked. So it's all COVID related. And it was only like a few weeks later that I had started to get really bad chest symptoms. And then since then, well, I think basically I then was discharged from hospital, went back into hospital for a bit, and then had like a week off work, felt so bad about not being at work. So obviously it was like the peak and I was like, I need to get back. And everyone was like telling me how, you know, understaffed they were. And so I basically went back way too early. And at that point, we had a lot of people who were kind of pregnant, so they couldn't work in the hospital. So then you're like covering, and if people go off, they don't kind of organise cover normally. And so I was under a lot of pressure, and I just worked myself into the ground until I think maybe was it a week and a half ago that regularly I would almost be falling asleep at the wheel, just absolutely extreme fatigue. And then I get quite breathless. And you could probably hear it when I talk.
Yeah,
like
you're more
in.
Breathless than you used to be. But when you were in hospital, you were really ill because you like would have to be breathing on the, not a ventilator, but like a, what's those masks?
Oh,
things?
Yeah, well, no, that was, I wasn't that bad. I was on the nebulizers.
But I feel like it was really scary because it's funny because when you're talking about it with you, you're making it sound like it wasn't that bad, but it was.
No,
quite,
yeah,
you
I'm
were really
sound,
ill.
I was very, very unwell. I didn't realize at the time.
Because you were in and out of hospital.
And my idea
weeks.
Of unwell is kind of different, I suppose.
Yeah, because you see such extremes.
I mean, my idea of unwell is that you're on the ventilator in intensive care. So I was unwell in the sense I was in the hospital, but I was, I mean, I could have died if I'd, if dad kept saying this to me, he's like, if your appendix ruptures and then I need to get taken to theatre, then I would have been the up shit's creek.
Can you explain, because the reason they can operate on the appendix is you can't have an operation when you have such bad COVID scarring.
No, you can, but it's just too risky. So like if you give someone a general anaesthetic and they've got a pneumonia,
right,
then I could potentially decompensate under general anaesthetic. And also if I had pneumonia because of COVID, put that whole team at risk. So because you can treat it with IV antibiotics, luckily mine responded, that was the safest option.
And now yours
has
just gone down.
Yeah, it's not come back. Not my chest symptoms, yeah, but the appendix.
So what are your long COVID symptoms? Because I think lots of people think you're young and really fit, you're really healthy, and they think that if you get it, you'll be fine.
Yeah, I think I'm an anomaly. It's not that I want like people to panic or scaremonger people, but I was a rare, I think, exception of how things can go wrong. So I'm 31, I'm fit and well, don't even have asthma, to the point, you know, I'm so healthy that when I was younger, I used to do
an
sport.
Athlete.
Like, I was a professional athlete, used to train like 18 times a week. And I think my immune system must have just gone into overdrive. And essentially now, so I've been off work for a week and a half. And the only reason that I sound like I'm normal now is I have genuinely slept for days and days on end to try and get myself to be able to function. So when I was working, I would get up for work and I would genuinely have to have about 6 coffees a day to try and keep me going. And I have to like drive to work, it's about an hour, which isn't too bad. But if you're has severe exhaustion, I would be so exhausted that I'd be driving to work and I would call mum. And poor mum, I didn't realise this, but she would be like crying at the other end of the phone because I couldn't stay awake. So I would be like, can you talk to me? I physically just can't. I was trying to say, wait, so I'd pull over and have like 10-minute naps. And then I would have to keep going. And so instead of taking me an hour, it would take me 2 hours. And the only way I could keep myself awake would be to like slap myself, which sounds really dramatic, but it would like get your adrenaline going. And I'd be like, right, I've got to stay awake, but or hold my eyes open. I genuinely just can't.
God,
I'd be that exhausted.
So
and I think by the time I get to work, people, it's such a funny thing, fatigue. Like people can't see it, so they don't really understand it. So I would say to them, look, I've genuinely nearly fallen asleep at the wheel. And because you can't see it, people don't really get it. And I think also in the NHS, people are just so inundated with work and so understaffed that you're thinking, God, we can't have another person go off sick. So I felt such a guilt that I was like, can't go off. I basically pushed myself for 8 months. To the point where I went and saw my GP and he was like, what are you doing? This is so unsafe. Like, one, if I kill someone else at the wheel, two, I might never get over this if I don't actually try and rest now. So I think people at work were thinking, oh, you know, it's just, if we could just stop the driving, then she'll be fine. But the driving is a symptom of how, I'm quite a stoic person. I do just keep going. So I get
you're
home
like,
and like
yeah.
have to just collapse. So my main thing is fatigue. And I'm hoping that will just go. Because I'm normally the type of person that could just be on like 5 hours sleep.
But it's interesting because it teaches you like what you're saying about people not seeing it. It's like so many people have invisible chronic illnesses that no one can see on the surface. And it's interesting how people like treat you versus if you can like visibly see that someone's got a broken neck or whatever it might be.
And whereas like at work, I wasn't dangerous to the point where I could function at work, but I would have to have a lot of coffee. So then it would seem like I was fine because I'd be probably high on caffeine. But for me, I knew like I'm very conscientious and I'm a bit of a perfectionist. So I like to do things perfectly. And I'm normally very speedy with what I do. So because the job I'm at now, they don't really know me. They probably thought, oh, it's fine. But they don't know the level. For me, I knew I didn't feel like I was.
You were off kilter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a funny thing because I feel bad about not being at work. But I think actually, if I didn't do it, I might end up like this for God knows how long.
Well, this is the longest you've ever taken off work ever.
Oh, yeah. So I'm hoping if I just sleep lots, then I'll give my body the chance to recover.
Yeah.
And also I get a lot of breathlessness as well, even like walking up and down the stairs. If I'm presenting a patient, I mean, I'm actually not too bad now, but normally at work, if I'm rushing, like between...
No, but I can hear you sometimes going like in between talking, which you wouldn't normally do.
No. So yeah, so you've got to be careful because you think, oh, I mean, on the whole, it's very unlikely, but I think I was a bad example, but you do just have to be careful.
Yeah, because we were so worried about dad getting it because he's in hospital.
Yeah, and then
and
he was fine.
I mean, and then Emily was in hospital for like 2 weeks and dad was like just having my Guinness and whatever
loving
food
life.
He's eating.
Oh no, I know, it's so rank.
Someone told me, oh my God, I forgot to say, someone replied to my Instagram story. On one of them, he was like, this meal was from a Hungarian neighbour
Yeah.
And someone replied being like, oh my God, that's my friend's family who like gave him that food. I don't know why they gave him food.
Why did you give him food?
We must have gone around and been like, can I have some food?
Oh my God, don't. I can't. Even, it like stresses me out so much.
Well, you've been such a good guest. Have you enjoyed your time on the podcast?
I have, but then I keep forgetting on the podcast and then it makes me a bit like, I've had a great time. Should we cut that out?
I think you've been such a good guest. You're actually way better than I was expecting.
Oh, really? Thank you. I'm surprised that you asked me on. I feel like I'm not that interesting.
I've been trying to get you on for ages and this is the only free time that you've ever had. Okay. Also, if people want to follow you, because you did start an Instagram, you should keep doing it.
Yeah, I've been really bad. So I did start an Instagram because you made me do it. And I do think it was a good idea, but I haven't... I know it sounds so bad, but I just haven't been well enough to do it. So I'm having a break from it at the moment, but I will... do it again at some point.
And it is at Dr. Dr.
Dr. Emily Forbat.
And there's loads of good posts on that, lots related to dermatology and
yeah,
things.
But I will get back to doing it again. It's hard work though.
I know. Well, I mean, it's not quite as hard as being a doctor, but...
No, it is hard. But I think it's a good one. But yeah, I need to make myself do it when I'm better. I'm making myself look...
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.